Good morning. In news none of us wanted to hear, we have a new variant.
Very, very early days yet, but it is a new strain in South Africa we're hearing about.
That's right. There's breaking news tonight, and I'm sorry if this is news for anyone who's just hearing it for the first time, because it is rather depressing. Every time we feel like we've turned a corner, there's some more bad news coming like this. So what we're learning tonight is that scientists have discovered a new variant with what they're saying is very unusual mutations.
Mary Minahan, assistant news editor with the Irish Times on Late Debate with Damien, just after 10 on Thursday evening. Okay, right, let's get into it. And while no one wants to be scaring anyone, according to Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College Kingston Mills with Claire yesterday morning, this is serious.
This is the most worrying variant we've seen yet. I was shocked last night when I read the reports about it. Really insidious. The mutations in the spike protein not only mimic those in the Delta, but also the Beta variant, the original South African variant. And that variant, if people may not remember, caused a real problem for the AstraZeneca vaccine, so much so that it only had 10% efficacy and South Africa stopped using it. So it has the worst of the Beta variant and the worst of the Delta variant in terms of transmissibility. So this is, people talked about game changers in vaccines. This is a game changer in terms of the viruses. So we've got to keep this virus out of Europe at all costs, including Ireland. So we need to put in place very stringent measures to quarantine, isolate anybody that's come either directly or indirectly from South Africa or other countries.
And as the day progressed, countries fell like dominoes, announcing travel bans to and from South Africa and other countries in Southern Africa, including Britain and many countries in the EU, with Ursula von der Leyen advocating a suspension of travel, while the WHO cautioned against travel bans as yet. So, what do we know so far about B.1.1.529? On yesterday's Morning Ireland, Mary spoke to Christine Loscher, Professor of Immunology at Dublin City University.
What's known so far?
Yes, Mary, and I think the concern is because we don't know as much as we'd like to know so far. So one of the key things I think that's concerning is the fact that there's a much higher number of mutations in this variant than we've seen before. There's a lot of mutations in the spike protein, which our vaccines target in terms of making antibodies to that protein. And we've seen the impact of having mutations in Delta and kind of a little bit of an impact on how good our vaccine is against Delta. And the concern is that we don't know quite yet how vaccine evasive this variant might be. So it's very much a watch and wait. In terms of waiting for some scientists to understand a bit more about the impact of these mutations. We do know that one of the mutations that it does have is similar to one in Alpha and Delta, which made it more transmissible. And that's also of concern that it might spread quite quickly. And I suppose the information we're getting is that this has become dominant in a small number of cases very, very quickly. And that is the concern.
And on Drive Time, Sarah spoke to Dr. Richard Lessels, infectious diseases specialist at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa.
On the ground in South Africa, what sort of evidence have you got at this point? For example, on people who have been vaccinated or been previously infected, are many people getting this new variant, and are they getting sick, very sick with this new variant?
Yeah, so these are the key questions. So what we're seeing, we are seeing a signal in the data that the number of reinfections may be going up from what we've seen up till now. So by that, I mean people who've had a previous infection and getting now reinfected, and we would presume that would be with this new variant. We are also seeing that some of the infections at the moment are in fully vaccinated individuals. But what we need over the next few days is to really get a very clear handle on that data. And as you said, the key thing is going to be understanding whether that's just mild infection in these cases, or whether we start to see severe disease and hospitalizations in people that have been fully vaccinated. That will take a bit of time.
Okay, so that is good to know, because I think people have been hearing over the last 24 hours this is, you know, a variant that could evade the vaccine. But what we don't know yet is whether or not that is causing people to get very seriously ill. That just simply is not known. There's no evidence to show it.
It's not. And what we've seen with the previous variants is that even if they can get around some of the protection and still cause infection, the vaccines hold up very well against severe disease and hospitalization. So clearly vaccination still remains key here to protect the most vulnerable people.
And while global vaccination is crucial, more anon, we here in the Global North have vaccines. On the News at One, Brian spoke to Professor James McInerney, head of the School of Life Sciences at the University of Nottingham.
So what's known about the capacity of existing vaccines to prevent either the spread of the disease or serious illness in those who become contaminated with this strain?
Okay, so I think it's very important to say that right now we don't know an awful lot. We know what the genome is like, we know what the mutations are like, and we know about its growth. So the things that we don't know are what you've just talked about there, vaccine escape, whether this is truly a vaccine escape variant. It has mutations that sort of certainly give us concern for that. We don't know about breakthrough infections, reinfection. We don't know how fast or slow it transmits, though it looks like it's pretty good at transmission, and we don't know what's the disease severity. So it's that new that the answers to those questions, we don't have them right now. So I really can't give you a good answer, but except to say that there's a lot of people working on it, and in a week's time we will know an awful lot more.
And just in that regard, what can you say about the capacity of the pharmaceutical companies to adjust the existing vaccines or devise new vaccines that can be effective against a new virulent strain like this?
Devising a new vaccine can be done in a week. It's very easy. It's really easy. I mean, the issue after that is vaccine safety and efficacy and all of those things. But devising one is pretty easy. And, you know, certainly dozens of good vaccines to the original strains or the original variants of COVID were developed. So that part is, we now think, is relatively easy, and changing existing vaccines, relatively easy. But they still would have to undergo safety trials, and it still would take time. It's not something you could do in the morning.
Professor James McInerney. And while no one likes an I told you so, here's Claire with Assistant Professor of Virology at Trinity College, Kim Roberts.
We had been warned about this, hadn't we? Particularly by the World Health Organization, which has said time and again, if the developing world is not vaccinated, we are going to have the emergence of a variant. Do you agree that that's what's happened here?
Absolutely. Any time we give viruses the chance to replicate, to spread from person to person in large numbers, it is inevitable that new mutations will arise, that we will get new variants. And the level of virus around the world at the moment is very high. So I think a lot of scientists were expecting that a new variant would appear. Now, it might not be this one. We don't know enough about this variant to know yet whether or not it will become disseminated around the world. But there are so many mutations that we do need to take it very, very seriously.
And that concern was very close to home for Dr. Richard Lessels in South Africa. Back to Sarah on Drive Time.
I'm very concerned, and I'm very concerned about what it means for Africa and the region, because there are still a huge number of vulnerable people in Africa who haven't yet even had the first dose of vaccine. And unfortunately, what we're seeing play out here is what many of us have been warning about for the past year, that if we continue to leave parts of the world behind and leave Africa behind with vaccination, then not only do we see the emergence of these variants, but we've left large chunks of the population unprotected by vaccines that could save their lives.
And we were warned about this.
We've warned continuously, and we get the same talk and the same commitments that are then not delivered on. What I've found most upsetting from Sajid Javid and from Ursula von der Leyen is that the travel ban, we can argue about whether it's effective and whether it's right. It's not so much the travel ban was put in, but it's when they make these statements that's the only thing that they talk about. And they don't talk about the support that they're going to give to Africa to help us control this pandemic here and to deliver on the commitments about vaccine delivery to Africa. So I find that increasingly upsetting that the approach when these things happen is still a very narrow approach, and it's not the global approach that's needed to deal with this pandemic.
Dr. Richard Lessels in South Africa, as heard on Drive Time. And there was other COVID news. Of course there was. Never don't. Masks for the kiddies from third class, boosters for all in the land, well, from 16 up, and maybe, just maybe, vaccines for children from 5 to 11. All of that. But really, all eclipsed, for now anyway, by B11529. Now classified by the WHO as a variant of concern and named Omicron. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Garth Brooks. Spurs out, Stetson's on, double denim at the ready, because he did indeed get his 5 gigs in Croke Park. And when Ray met Garth and the Darcy locked eyes with the Brooks, it was a bit of a bromance.
Everybody wanted a bit of Garth. And we were, like, Niamh went in, like, you know, a German tourist, are you allowed to say that? And she put the towels on the loungers, not really, but she put her jacket on the seats in the front row. So we were in the front row at the press conference. I know, I'm getting excited. It was exciting. And at one stage, we weren't asking any questions because we knew we had our time with him, one-on-one. Did I mention that? Yeah. And so at one stage, he just looked me straight in the eye and he said, "How you doing?" And I said, "All right, how are you doing?" He said, "Good." And this was in the middle of the whole thing was going on around him. And he just took time to say hello to me, which I thought was nice.
Oh, Garth, let's get a room.
And we followed a guy called Keane up to room 649. And we were allowed to set up our gear and then wait. Eventually, after I pocketed a banana from the complimentary fruit bowl, because I knew I'd need a bit of energy going back, so I put that into my bag. Anyway, eventually he arrived, and I just wanted to make sure he was comfortable and was he okay, and you know, you fuss, don't you? You fuss.
Are you comfortable? Do you want to sit here? I can sit there. Whatever.
I'm good.
You're good.
Whatever works for you.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for this.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity.
No, thank you, Garth Brooks, and welcome to Ireland.
Thank you.
it's reaching the land of 1,000 welcomes this morning for you, isn't it?
I'll tell you what, it can be 1,000 more. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
So happy, man. Just so happy that this is actual. Looks like it's going to happen.
Oh, it's happening, all right. But Ray wasn't going to let the great Stetson go without bringing up the ghosts of Croker's past.
You know, I've watched you and you've said this on numerous occasions, the curse and the blessing.
Yes.
All right. So the cancellation of the 2014 gigs, curse. Like, let's right. be honest, everyone agrees with that. So where is the blessing in that for you?
I think the blessing is instead of starting with it, we're ending with it.
Uh-huh.
I like it. So we'll never do another stadium run ever again because it's just too hard on the band and crew. I'm the last guy in the building and the first one to leave. It's easy for me. But this crew, they're away from their families way too long. Like when they start out in March this year, they'll be gone probably for 6 straight months.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
I will be flying to the gig, you know, Friday and then back home Saturday. So it's, I think this is definitely be our last run. So 22 will end the stadium run and we'll end it here. I don't know how you end it any better than being here.
Well, here's the thing. Still on numbers. At the beginning of that press conference, you were talking to Miss Sinead from
yes.
RTE, and she asked you about the possibility of 5.
Right. I told her she was crazy.
You were using words like, no way, impossible.
Right.
Okay. I was watching you very closely. By the end of it, you were counting out 5
well,
on your fingers.
Yes.
Whichever
one of those numbers come in, I'll feel very, very fortunate to get to play here.
Yeah.
Gee shucks, did the 5 dates come through? You know they did. Well, one fan who was happy and a woman who had queued for 3 days back in 2014 was Aislinn O'Donoghue.
Tell us about your morning. How did it go?
Oh my God, it was absolutely crazy. We logged on to Ticketmaster at about 7:30 this morning. We had a laptop on the go and two phones. 120,000 people in front of me in the queue. You could see the queue moving and it wasn't budging. So then all of a sudden one of the phones, it started flying up the queue and we were like, okay, just stay in the queue. Let's just stay in the queue. And sure, it was panic stations. So yes, all of a sudden it just went from like 9,000 to 500. Yeah. So then I saw the 500 and I was like, oh my God, okay. Then it went from like 500 to 100. Then it went to like 20. Then all of a sudden it said, stand by, grabbing your tickets or whatever way they phrase it. And you had the spinning cog and the spinning cog kept spinning for 10 minutes. So we were like, do we have them or do we not have them? Do we have them or do we not have them? And lo and behold, there was my tickets.
Brilliant. Result.
Oh my
Result.
God.
A happy Garth Brooks fan. But I'll tell you who won't be going. Beatles fans Jim O'Mahony and Dave.
Jim, will you go to Garth Brooks?
Absolutely not.
Why?
No, I wouldn't cross the road to see him, sorry.
I'm going for a pint with Jim. I wouldn't cross anything to see... I mean, seriously, what is wrong with crying out loud? Yeah. What's happened to music?
But look, I mean, all these people can't be wrong. They can't be.
They are.
We're saying nothing. Let's move on to safer subjects like badger poo, because it turns out badgers are ideal fruit seed distributors, and blackberries in particular. Here's Aina with Dr. Paddy Sleeman, senior researcher at the School of Biological Earth and Environmental Sciences at UCC. And he is a man intimately acquainted with the toilet habits of said animal.
Badgers are very clean creatures and do not do their droppings willy-nilly all over the place. They have a more refined setup, do they not, Paddy?
That's correct, Inna. And this has only recently been discovered that we used to think that birds were the major dispersers of fruits, birds and primates such as ourselves. But we now know that predators such as badgers, they have a short digestion time, they've got a big body and they move around a lot. And that makes them ideal for dispersing things like blackberries. And oddly, despite the fact that they have a notoriously hard bite, they damage very few seeds. And the digestion in the badger's gut seems to smooth the edges of the seed coat and make the blackberry seeds germinate more abundantly and faster than blackberry seeds that don't go through badgers. As you pointed out, they also put them in pits, in what we call a fecal pit, which is part of a badger latrine. So they effectively sow them and provide them with surrounding fertilizer. This is why we call badgers ecosystem engineers, because they disperse a lot of plants and fungi, and their sets, their burrows, are enormous, often more than a kilometre underground.
And as Aina noted, no willy-nilly latrine use here, no. They are creatures of habit, and where they drop their, well, droppings is not a matter of chance.
Badgers have the same sets from year to year to year. Are we not just getting a thicket of blackberries where the latrines were?
Yes, that's precisely right. If you like, evolution is a two-paper exam. In one case, the badgers must survive, and in the second case, they must breed. And the fruits of blackberries enable badgers, first of all, to put on weight in autumn to survive through the winter, and second of all, to breed. And it's probable that badgers that eat blackberries were selected for, and blackberries that attracted badgers, i.e. they grow low in the plants, were also selected for. So we're talking about an evolutionary mutualism.
And if you think the badger blackberry union is a jammy one, yes, we did. We humans do a mean fig.
We know that humans evolved in African fig galleries in East Africa. And figs, if you think about the way you eat figs, you get that sensation with your teeth. The seeds get stuck and you swallow them without grinding them up. And we were probably major dispersers of figs when we were evolving in East Africa.
Aren't we all of us such fascinating creatures? That was Dr. Paddy Sleeman from Mooney Goes Wild. Now to an interview. Claire did with Amanda Brown on Tuesday. It was when Amanda spoke about her stepfather, Davy Tweed. It was a powerful interview with a remarkable woman, but it is not an easy listen and may be particularly upsetting for some, so just bear that in mind. Tweed is a former Ireland rugby player and unionist politician who died in October this year in a motorcycle crash. However, Tweed was also a paedophile and a bully who abused his daughters and was violent to his family in the home. When Amanda's mother married Davy Tweed, they would go on to have four daughters together. And Claire asked Amanda when she believed her stepfather's abuse of her might have begun.
The abuse, you say your first memory is when you were eight, but you believe that perhaps it started earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Then your sisters, there was a bit of an age gap, wasn't there, between you and your younger sisters?
Yes, there's 5 years between myself and the next youngest sister. So there's 5 years between me and his first daughter.
One of the really impactful things that you've said over the course of the last couple of weeks is that you didn't say anything because you thought that that was going to protect them. If you put up with it, that they wouldn't suffer.
Yep, yep. Because that's what he made me believe.
And Tweed threatened her with what might happen if she told anyone.
You speak about one time when you confronted him and he started to cry.
Yeah.
What was going on there?
It was manipulation is what was going on there. He was silencing me. He cried and told me he would go to jail if I told anybody. And that's when he followed up with, and your sisters will, you know, well, you'll be in an orphanage and you'll be split up and your mum will be begging on the street with your youngest sister, who was only a baby at the time. And that's the image that I had in my mind. That's what I didn't want. I kept my secrets, kept his secrets, so that wouldn't happen.
So him using the tears, that happened when you were a child still?
Yeah, yeah.
And she talked about growing up with the ever-present threat of violence.
We grew up with domestic violence, you know, and I don't want to say you become desensitized to it, but there's certain situations that you do, you know. It's like when I'm talking now, it's almost like I'm desensitized to the whole situation, to everything that has happened, because I have lived experience of it and have processed it and worked through it. But the domestic violence was pretty bad. It's like he was very violent towards my mum. There were times he left her face even in quite a state.
Did you see that happening?
I didn't see him physically hit her. He always done it when we were in bed or out of the way. But we would either, if we were there in the house, we would hear what was going on and then see the aftermath.
I just have in my head this image of this man. What was he, 6'6"?
Yep, 6'6".
Like a huge tank of a rugby player. Inflicting not just the most horrific sexual abuse on little children, but also using his fists to hurt people, to hurt his wife and your siblings.
Yeah.
And didn't he make your mother on occasion explain to you guys why he had hit her?
He would drag her into our bedroom, sometimes by the hair, and have her stand sobbing in our bedroom telling us that she deserved the beating that she had just received.
It just renders me speechless that she would have lived like that. I mean, she was with him for how long? 23 years?
I'm not entirely sure, but he was put out around sort of like when I was about 26, 27. So, yep. Mm-hmm.
When Amanda was an adult, she went to the police.
At this point, it wasn't about removing his power. It was about me processing the guilt that I had on hearing about everybody else. That is something that I still struggle with quite a bit, was the guilt of hearing that my younger sisters, you know, and I had watched them growing up thinking that I would know if anything had ever happened to them. And I didn't. I didn't see it. And I carried a lot of guilt with me for that. And It was the guilt. I got to a stage where I was like, I could not forgive myself if I heard about somebody else.
The court case was held in 2012 with an unrepentant Davy Tweed. He was convicted and given an 8-year sentence. He served 4 years in jail. But his conviction was quashed on appeal because of how the judge had addressed the jury on the bad character clause during the trial.
For him to be released and all that effort and all that heartache and trauma and stress that we went through during the court case initially, for that to just be swept away was hard.
However, in the aftermath of his death in October, many paid tribute to Tweed.
The offers of condolences to yourself and your family, some unionist politicians calling him a giant of a man, a larger-than-life character. How do you hear those? I'm saying that, and I still have this image of the 6-foot-6 man and the 8-year-old child.
Yeah. No, well, yeah, and I have that image of him at home, and I have who I knew him as at home. But I have to also accept that other people have their memories of who he was to them. Because he wasn't to them what he was to me. He hid that part of himself very, very well. And when he was out and playing rugby and you were on the same team as him, he was probably the best person ever. Do you know, to some people, he probably was great. And he probably was a great man to many people. But they didn't know all of him. They didn't see all of him where I did. So
you have told what the other side was. The other victims who gave evidence that court case, they've told what he was, you know?
Well, we did, but not everybody's going to, you know, they're not going to believe everybody. You know, it's something that I have accepted and faced even whenever I was going to the police. It was, you know, I had to accept here that people are going to think that I'm telling lies. Even though I'm standing in my truth, people are going to think I'm lying. And that's something that as a victim that you grow up with, that you deal with, you know, and for some people it keeps people quiet. That's what keeps people quiet.
And she talked about how she feels now that her stepfather has died.
I felt peace knowing that he can, like, I don't know who else he could have hurt, but just peace knowing that he can't hurt anybody else anymore.
And she is, as she told Claire, standing in her truth so that others may have the courage to do the same.
I mean, there would have been a time I wouldn't have been able to say I was abused. There was a time I couldn't have said that, but I can say it now. Do you know, and I've been saying it since the first time I said it about 10, 11 years ago is the first time I said it. And I have kept saying it ever since, and it gets easier and easier, and you heal. Every time you can say it, you heal. Because nobody likes to be called a victim, and I didn't like that either. Didn't want to be called a victim. But in reality, I was. He made me a victim.
Do you feel that way now?
No. No. No, I don't.
How do you describe yourself today?
I feel empowered for being able to stand in my truth. And I'm happy that what I am saying and that my words are bringing either comfort to some people or giving them the strength to speak up.
A remarkable individual, Amanda Brown, talking to Claire Byrne. Back in a bit. Welcome back. There was a Fab Four love-in this week ahead of the long-awaited release of Peter Jackson's epic, The Beatles, Get Back. His take on the making of Let It Be, and also the publication of the lyrics 1956 to the present, Paul McCartney with poet Paul Muldoon. So where to begin? Maybe with the music.
I Dig a Pygmy by Charles Hawtrey and the Deaf Aids. Phase one in which Doris gets her oats.
We're going home.
a crime to fade, but we must. From Let It Be, not quite the album that broke them, but close. And now the 56 hours of fly-on-the-wall footage has been crafted by Peter Jackson into a new documentary, just released. But Dave Fanning, as always, was out of the traps last weekend when he spoke to the director who shot the original footage, Michael Lindsay Hogg.
That the film that he brought out, the original Let It Be, was a very appropriately balanced movie. I mean, there were both happy and tense moments in it. But in the years that have gone by, people have said of it, there was only quarrelsome stuff where people didn't get on. And now, you know, that there's some kind of righting of wrongs with this new Peter Jackson 8-hour special coming out. It just wasn't like that at all, was it?
there's a piece coming out in the New York Times this weekend, I think, where Peter says pretty much what you've just said.
Yeah.
Because he's got so much of a larger canvas than I had, that he's able to show them certainly getting on, rehearsing, being as affectionate as they always were, but then also moments of tension, moments of friction, as would happen with any group of artists trying to do a piece of work. I think the misconception about Let It Be was that it was the breakup movie, whereas in fact, we shot it in January 69, we finished it, I think, in September 69. It was ready to go, it didn't go out at the right time, and then it was looked at as the breakup movie, which it wasn't, because they didn't break up while we were doing the movie.
But maybe something we forget at this remove was just how young they were. Famous rock stars? Absolutely. But also, young men in a hurry.
That's one of the things which Peter Jackson said to me. He said, I've been lucky because I've been working with Paul and Ringo. They've been, you know, I've been consulting them as we've been going through this procedure. And they're 80 now, 79 and 80. And as Peter said, when I had them, it was like herding a bunch of cats. And they were full of talent, rage, anger, love, all the things you go through when you're 26, John was 28, Paul was 27, George was 26, Ringo was 28. They were still young men in the heat of battle.
Yeah.
And they also were very much, as you alluded to a second ago, trying to figure out what to do with their lives.
And with all of those tensions, the songwriting partnership of John and Paul was famously under strain. But there was a bedrock of friendship there too.
You know, like John and Paul, for instance, were rivals, but they were friends. They were mostly friends.
Oh, mostly. Not only, they were brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they'd known each other since the time they were 15 and 16. They both had the shared tragedy of their mothers dying when they were young, which I think was a bond between them. Yeah, you know, when someone said to Paul after John was murdered, how do you feel about that? And he said, it's a drag, man, it's a drag. Yeah. How can you ask him what he felt about the death of his friend, his brother, his partner? I mean, what's he going to say?
But what about the filming of that concert? Was it really so simple as, hey, let's head up the stairs onto the roof?
Was the greatest concert ever filmed, i.e. that one, was that as spontaneous as that?
Not at all. What we needed was to have some kind of conclusion, because otherwise we're just going to have Twickenham, which was looked good, but they were a bit depressed, Apple rehearsing, and then we'd have nowhere to go. There was no climax. But the funny thing is they didn't totally agree they were going to do it until we were standing in a small room beneath the stairs, which led up to the roof at 12:30, and they were going to do it. And they were split. Two of them didn't particularly want to do it. One of them did very much, and one of them wasn't heard from for a while. The roof was not spontaneous because it couldn't be that spontaneous because we had to get Billy Preston's organ up there.
Yeah.
And of course, because I have schoolboy humor, whenever I say something like, we had to get Billy Preston's organ up there.
Hey!
And we had to get the amps, we had to get the drum kit, we had to get it all. And Dave, we had to get 11 cameras.
Yeah.
So that wasn't something you just rustle up overnight like eggs and bacon.
And on Sunday, a veritable Paul Fest with Muldoon on McCartney and their collaboration on the lyrics 1956 to the present. And yes, you might have a Pulitzer Prize Paul Muldoon, but McCartney, he's a Beatle. So was this a dream gig?
You're such a music fan and you are so musical yourself. When he said this to you, how did you feel?
You know, what can one say? I mean, Paul McCartney is a hero, and you know, he's been part of the lives of, I suppose, anybody really who has been semi conscious roughly speaking, 1960 or the early 60s. In any case, I'm such an idiot that had I thought about it, I probably wouldn't have done it. But as a person who doesn't really think much about what it might all mean, I sort of, you know, embarked on it quite gaily, It turned out to be really a terrific adventure. It was so much fun. Maybe five or six times a year we met over the past 5 years. And on each occasion we sat down for usually 3 hours and we discussed in detail the background to half a dozen lyrics in each case. And over those 5 years we worked our way through 154 of them.
Oh, that's impressive. So what's he like? Come on.
He is a very upbeat person. He's possibly the most upbeat person I've ever met. The word I've used a couple of times, and I'll use it again because I can't think of a better one, is joyous. He's a joyous person. He is a life-affirming person. He's had his trials and tribulations in life like the rest of us, but he manages somehow to take a brightish view of things, you know, and I think that actually comes across in his songs and may even be one of the things that have made people so happy. Absolutely. To be listening to his songs.
Now, Muldoon teaches a class at Princeton entitled How to Write a Song. And in the joy of Zoom era, McCartney joined in.
Needless to say, I didn't tell them that he was coming in. You know, in each case, he actually began by commenting on the song that he just heard, giving notes on it.
Wow.
Talking about what he had liked about it, what maybe areas that could do with a little revisiting. And he was great.
Ooh, talented and lovely. But back to Get Back. And Arena asked Sarah Stacey and Paul McLoone to give their verdict on Jackson's docuseries.
It actually took him 4 years to edit this. They used the same technology and restoration processes as Jackson had used on his World War I documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old. And actually, one of the big criticisms of the original Let It Be movie was that the footage was very dark and grainy. And that was because halfway through, they had decided to switch from what was supposed to be a TV special to a feature film.
Yeah.
The 16mm footage was blown up to 35mm. So that's what
that grainy aspect. Whereas now technology has allowed them to, you get it, it's beautiful. You get colour. I kind of saw the Beatles, Paul, in a way I hadn't seen them before in terms of just physically seeing them in a type of colour that I wasn't used to seeing them in.
Absolutely. There's something almost hyper-real about it. And you're kind of, it's a very immersive movie, not least because of its length, of course. You have to let it sort of just happen, and rather than trying to find a thread or a narrative necessarily through it, it's a series of brilliant little moments that happen, and you're right there in the middle of it. And like you say, it's just so kind of colourful, and also cleaning up the audio, which they had techniques where they could just take a piece of audio that normally you wouldn't be able to hear what people are saying because there's something else happening, like a guitar or the drums playing or whatever. But they've managed to develop a technology now that can isolate those bits of dialogue. Yeah, and you can actually hear stuff. You can actually hear exchanges, some of them fascinating, between Lennon and McCartney, for example, that you wouldn't have been able to hear maybe as recently as 5 or 6 years ago. The technology is so cutting edge that he's using.
Did they enjoy it? Yes, they did. How much? This much.
It's the late, late toy show for Beatles geeks.
All right.
Bringing us with a roar to full-time Beatle geek and part-time Lion King, no doubt fast asleep under a pile of tinsel-covered coats after last night's toy show shenanigans. But all week long, he was on the build-up.
Do you remember the ad for Reach toothpaste or the toothbrush? And the head flipped open. You say, what's in there? If you flip my head open and say, what's in there? This is what you'd hear. That's it. That's my head today. All day. Just for the next 24 hours. Everywhere I turn. Left, right. Phenomena. Can I have some tea? Phenomena. Can I get some chips with that? Phenomena. Coffee, sweets, jellies, whatever you can. So I'm not going to take too much seriously today. I hope you understand. 515.
Now that was Thursday. The gig's on Friday. Fair enough. But we hit peak giddy when Dave phoned in.
I have 7 kids.
I'd ask you to name them, but the show'd be over and I wouldn't be able to give you the vouchers. Okay, you need this prize. What Mexican food has a name meaning little donkey?
Little donkey?
Yeah, like a little Ito, something. A big Mexican thing. It's got loads of gunk in it, like...
Freaking... Oh, what do you call it?
Yeah.
Janie.
Yeah, not Janie. It rhymes with Ferrito.
Burrito.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, can you name this Francis Ford Coppola movie about the Corleone family? Do I even need to tell you what it is? Let's see. Come
over here, kid. Learn
something.
The Sopranos,
no? Nah, you're gonna be... No, it's like... It's Marlon Brando, Robert De Niro...
Goodfellas.
Ah, Jesus. It's not The Godmother.
Oh, The Godfather.
Oh, okay, according to Tesco's... See, I'm against the clock here. My nerves are gone. I've got the toy show on Friday night. Now you're here getting everything wrong. Everything wrong. Like, you couldn't even get anything wronger. Okay, quick. According to Tesco's 2021 Christmas report, what food is still king for Christmas? Is it the ham, the goose, or the turkey?
The turkey.
Oh, I don't know how you got that, but it's the correct answer. Okay, let's keep going here. Name this celebrity chef.
But I still need... a bit of milk, full fat, which I've warmed in the microwave.
Who's that?
Oh, you're one.
That'll do it. Your one is right. Let's move on. Now, this is the final question. David.
Yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
Okay, you're working. You're doing so well. What preserve is Christina and the gals looking for in this song from Moulin Rouge? You're going to go through everything, aren't you? Peanut butter, Marmite.
Marmalade.
Oh, for the win. 7 out of 7. David, I don't know how you hold down a real job. Congratulations.
I don't know either.
Oh,
I wish I had to risk it.
You can, of course, even if it is sort of just about hearing you. But yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. I speak pure fluent static, but no, I get the point. I think he's saying something like Happy Christmas and you seem like a really nice guy and, you know, I really like your show. I think that's what he was saying. Would that be roughly speaking?
Absolutely. Now turn over, Ryan. A lie-in, well deserved. That is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.